I'd like to welcome you all on behalf of the students and associates of the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia, New York City, and Washington, D.C., to our symposium day. As you know, we take turns in hosting this event. This year, the students and associates of the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia are pleased and proud to have our guests join in this event with us. The theme for this year's presentation, a new cycle of opportunity and challenge. And it is clear to any one of us that we are in times in which the society and the world around us seems to be heading to disintegration, chaos, and dramatic change. That's the challenge. The opportunity, though, is that at the same time we see locally and around the world pockets culturally and in science, religion, philosophy, independent thinkers collecting together and setting the seeds for a new cycle of great opportunity for evolution of humanity in various ways. So we are going to explore the various dimensions of this process. This morning we are going to be looking at this time as a pivotal moment in history, a pivotal moment being a critical moment when, in spite of all the challenges and difficulties and chaos around us, we also see a new cycle arising and the opportunity for greater expansion and development. And historians have been tracking this through the years, and one of the previous times, which is very much like our own, in which there was a relatively sudden gap in crisis created in the civilized countries of the world, a vacuum and new processes politically, socially, economically developed. Of course, we're speaking of 476 AD with the fall of the Eastern Roman Empire and the developments that took place in Europe and in the Middle East at that time. Now, for those of you who are familiar with theosophy and cycles, you know if we move 1,500 years from that date, we come to 1976. So it shouldn't be surprising to us that many of the challenges we face today have their predecessors in this previous cycle. So if we go back 1,500 years, we see that those that understood the cycles that were coming made some preparatory efforts to try to get the impulse moving in a better and higher direction. And that came in the place of Alexandria, Egypt, the Pearl of the Mediterranean, and City of the Mind. We'd like to begin this part of the presentation with a quote from a classical poet of the time who said in one of his amusing lines, Herodotus describes the city of Alexandria as a place where everything imaginable could be found. Wealth, palaestrae, power, prosperity, glory, shows, philosophers, gold, youth, the temple of the Adelphoi, the generous king, Lucian, wine, all the good things you may desire, and women more numerous than heavenly stars who could compete in beauty with the goddesses who sought the judgment of Paris. A combination of attractions enough to turn any man's heart and head. So it was indeed the pearl of the Mediterranean, of civilization at that time, but as we will see in our first presentation, a city of the mind.
Thank you. was just said, Alexandria was called the Pearl of the Mediterranean and the City of the Mind. And we are reminded certainly of the old Hermetic statement, as above, so below, when we're thinking of a pearl and how it's established. In order to understand how these great cycles of history came about, we have to realize or remember what the Mediterranean world looked like, and to recall as well that Alexandria today is on the westernmost flank, if you will, of the Nile Delta, where the Nile hits the Mediterranean Sea. It was a very, very ancient port. It had existed for thousands of years under other names, and today it exists as well, although the barrier island of Pharos Island is now, as you can see, more like a spit, if you will. The poem that was just quoted by Dr. Levy was Herodotus, the Greek poet of the 3rd century, and he certainly made Alexandria and many of those previous thousands of years sound more like Las Vegas than anything else, or perhaps more like the Trocadero area of Philadelphia, if you will. But from a philosophical point of view, a student in Pasadena wrote that any age is the souls that are incarnated in it and the karma that they are working out. Without creative individuals, there would not have been an age of Pericles. And in time, the civilization loses its virility and sinks. Alexandria was in a low period culturally, if you will. There was a lot of trade going on, and then it did begin to rise, like any cycle of civilization, like we're used to seeing an old sine curve, where you hit a crest of bloom, but there's a lot of preparation after, a lot of growth even until the next crisis state. The roots of Alexandria, as we know it from a theosophical point of view, go back to Hellenic Greece. That is the Greek that was organized, if you will, by Philip of Macedonia. The entire Balkan Peninsula was organized under him. And he married, in part of that merging, a woman named Olympias, who was princess of Epirus. And she herself was said to be a descendant of Achilles, who in turn was supposed to be the son of a sea goddess, Thetis. So we see in the very roots of the individual in history that is going to bring about this beginning of a bloom of Alexandria as we know it, the overlay, if you will, of ancient religions, legends, myths, and the bloom that is Alexander the Great. From the history books, you would know him certainly as a conqueror, the person who developed this incredible Hellenistic empire that went all the way from Greece and that original Balkan Peninsula all the way over to the edge of China, that incorporated what we now call the Near East and certainly well into the Alexandrian and upriver throughout Egypt into the higher edges of the Nile. What is not normally taught in history classes is that this individual had a personal calling about wanting to merge all of Europe and Asia as one entity, that he was very much about blending cultures, and we see why, and again, this would have seeds of implications for the Theosophical movement. At 14 years old, he studied under a gentleman named Aristotle. And under Aristotle, he developed this vision of tolerance and respect and mutual admiration and interest in races of other men. At 20 years old, he did lead his armies to the point where that huge Hellenistic kingdom took off. But he was also the mind behind the notion that the Greeks should settle and marry and root in the nations around that Hellenistic empire. And he was also the individual who wanted very much to have a trade of plants, cultures, languages, and knowledge. When he traveled into the Libyan desert, he went to an oracle that was in honor of Jupiter and Ammon, and was named the son of Jupiter, and told that Jupiter, as Jupiter, he could rule the world. The third century of Alexandria is known also as a nursery of every single race known to man. In addition to the trade and the people that were moving back and forth, there was also this blending, if you will, of cultures. Alexander died very, very young, and then there are three Ptolemies, three Hellenistic Greeks who take on the Egyptian title, Soter, Philadelphus, who of course we're very happy about, and Ptolemy III, around 200 BCE. Under these leaders, the Greek theorists melded with the Egyptian pragmatists. There were the birth of lesser and greater mysteries, the rise of the city of the mind that was mentioned in the title took over. There was a tremendous museum or university in our modern language, and certainly the great library, who was also put under the control of an Athenian named Demetrius, who was very, very involved in bringing about the city of the mind. So what you have to envision is, while that Las Vegas thing probably continued, especially along the port sides of the dual port, in the city itself, you have a bloom of a variety of different cultures and ideas. In terms of lesser mysteries, externals, we could talk about the Alexandrian study of number in geometry and architecture, or what they did with alloys, with metals like gold and silver. We could talk about astronomy, the studies that they did of the stars. There was music. The first pipe organ in the world is in Alexandria in this time period. Anatomy, the study of the human nature, was really, really big. And at the university, certainly literature was important. And then you yourself may know of some of the accomplishments. The lighthouse on Pharos Island, which was about a third of the size as the Empire State Building, but that was in 270 before the Common Era. The translation of the Old Testament of the Hebrews into Greek so that it could be shared throughout the world and traded for other sacred scriptures. The heliocentric theory, an accurate calculation of the circumference of the earth, and then of course Euclid's favorite and amazing textbook that was used in Europe and the Americas straight through to about maybe 100 years ago or so. But again, from the view of theosophy and a student of theosophy, wherever you see those lesser mysteries taught publicly, wherever you see that kind of intellectual bloom of mind, you can be pretty sure that behind the scenes there are also greater mysteries being taught, being promoted, and so that a candidate who readies himself or herself ethically and morally is gradually led stage by stage to the birth of the God within. And that brings us to the kinds of soul wisdom that we know from Alexandria that were revived or represented, if you will, by Blavatsky in her call that there is no religion higher than truth. And certainly, again, looking into each of the religious philosophies for what the source is and what the source is about. We are reminded that she spoke, you can go through the secret doctrine with the introduction to that. You can go into Isis in the section before the veil and see that she's very, very focused on what happened out at Alexandria. She said this period in which there is this ever flowing from a perennial source begins with the Buddha and Pythagoras. So we've got India and Greece, and that's one end of the time frame. And then the other end of the time frame is the Neoplatonists and the Gnostics in Alexandria. She also, throughout the SD, talks about the Alexandrian initiates and how there was a mystery language, how that the Gnostics, probably the bloom, if you will, of Brahmanic and then Essenian and then Gnostic philosophy, they held certain concepts to be true. I'm sure the second talk will go into that. In far greater detail. But she affirms again that the Alexandrian Gnostics have sufficiently divulged the secret of initiations and teachings about an array of spiritual beings and those spiritual beings coming before all material. One example among the many of individuals who would have passed through Alexandria in the first century BC would be Apollonius. And we know for sure that from historical sites that he studied with the Pythagoreans, the Persian Magi, the sages of Kashmir. All of this plowed the soil, as it were, for a full bloom of a Neoplatonic eclectic school of philosophy. And again, the effort of reconciling all people and all sects into the original root form of one faith. The sense, the intuitive, heartfelt sense that there's one supreme, unknowable, ineffable source of all, and that functions or periodically is manifest by law, through law, to purify all of the lower elements as we know them, and that by living a pure, dedicated, virtuous, devotional life, the ecstasy of Plotinus could be reached. Now, having said all that, those opportunities of learning existed in this wild whirlwind. The poet we spoke about earlier was actually very bawdy in his poetry. It's hair-raising. And all of these things that happened to Alexandria, if you look at the number of times that something was burned, starting with Julius Caesar, Aurelian burning out the museum, all of it, whether it's the Serapeum, what they tried to do was save all the literature that frankly they were getting from boats. A boat would pull in and they would say to the boat, you can't leave until you give us any literature that you've got on board. They would take the literature off. The scribes would convert that literature from whatever land it was into Greek, give the original back to the boat owner, and then the boat could return to wherever it wanted to go. So all these things that were burned, and certainly by 415 when Hypatia was slaughtered, this, despite all this, all of those mystery schools were intact and flourishing. They were sending out roots to the entire world as they knew it. And there was even an initiate emperor of Rome, Julian, who tried desperately to get Rome to turn around and to follow a theosophical line of thinking. So we're assured from the viewpoint of HPB and a number of sources that although things were burned, the literature still exists, and that it is held in abeyance until the time when it's morally safe to bring it back. And that's reiterated as well in the writings of William Q. Judge in The Ocean, if you look in the cycle chapter. So we're reminded there is an immutable law, that there is a spiritual font of wisdom that periodically comes forth, and that it is presented in terms of opportunity and challenge. And it's our point of view that determines that, isn't it? Stole this from Facebook yesterday. Sometimes when things are falling apart, they may be actually falling into place. And there we have the role of Alexandria, if you will. Okay.
The lights, please. At this time, we'd like to ask the remaining presenters for this morning to come up and take their seats at the table.
Don't be afraid, these are very small children upstairs.
While we're waiting for the presenters to take their place, it reminds us that things reoccur in cycles. When this city of Philadelphia was founded, William Penn, as you all know, laid it out on the grid system. And of course, the grid system was not new. It had been used in other cities of Europe. What was unique about Philadelphia when it was set up is it was set up not only with the grid system, but there was a central plaza where a city hall now stands, and four squares, each of the four quarters of the city. Interestingly enough, Alexandria was laid out on a grid civic system, and there were four quarters of that city, although unlike Philadelphia, the different cultures and backgrounds would have their center in each of those quarters. And of course, down by the river, where the commercial, all the goods were delivered, is of course one of the key ports in the world, as was Philadelphia at one time, the main seaport for industry in the world. And that area along the riverfront in Alexandria eventually became the area where the workers and merchants who were struggling and trying to maintain the underlying commerce of the city lived. That same thing happened in Philadelphia, what we call Society Hill today along the waterfront. In the earlier times was a similar area where the struggling underlying workers for the city lived, and the more wealthy folks moved west. One of those original four squares we have right out here, Rittenhouse Square. And it's interesting that during the Revolutionary and Civil Wars, those squares were used as burial grounds, except one, Rittenhouse Square. It's not a burial ground. Relief. But we'll go more into that later this morning. Okay, so we'll now have our first presenter take your questions and comments on the first presentation. Yes?
I do have a question. You were explaining how a lot of the libraries and a lot of the texts were burnt. That was not part of the plan. The information was held together and preserved despite others burning. That wasn't part of a theosophical plan to burn it, because that doesn't make sense to me. Was that part of the plan to burn it?
That's an interesting question. We know that in the teaching of karma, there are no accidents. And what HPB says throughout the SD is that there comes a time when, because of the nature of the souls who are incarnating, it becomes extremely dangerous to present major ideas. It becomes dangerous. We know that we do not have the full secret doctrine as it is known by the masters, because ethically we're just not there developmentally as a collective. So, by law, these acts of violence and these power plays by other individuals were karma playing out. They were played out from 48 BC all the way through to the last big fire in 400 of the Common Era. So that's almost across 500 years. So while this tug of war is going on with the rise of the Roman Empire and the rise, frankly, of the Christian Empire, there was plenty of time, there was ample time to move those scriptures and sacred texts, now beautifully translated into Greece, into hiding places, so that when the time was right, they could reappear. So what occurs to me is that the Rosetta Stone that Champollion found and then was translated, where they could line up Greek and Hebrew, etc., and do the translations in the late 1800s, that happens right before Blavatsky's publicly teaching again. So was this a good thing? I don't know, out of the worst manure grow the best roses. So by law, there was wisdom going on.
We think, though, the point of the question was addressed, that it was not part of the theosophical plan that was burning, although there might be anticipation of it, that would occur, and therefore measures were taken to protect the most valuable of those texts.
Mm-hmm. Also, they're saying the most valuable of the texts would be hidden still, like the Gnostic Bibles, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, were underground in deserts.
They're saying a lot of these texts were saved in the subcontinent of India, that a lot of them, the lesser mysteries, the math and science stayed alive in and among the Arabs throughout the Middle East. And then it's once the Renaissance starts in Europe, the information begins to flow back in psychically.
I followed that. I noticed it might not be part of it, but what is the Rosetta Stone? What is
the Rosetta Stone was a fragment that was found in the late 1800s, and it was found by a young boy in Egypt. When they got it back to France, they became very alert to the fact that the three columns of ideographs or glyphs, one of them was Greek. And because they could read the Greek, they could then begin to translate the other ancient languages that were on that. Once that fell into place, that was like a keystone, the ability to translate ancient documents began to bloom.
It's ironic that Rosetta Stone is actually a listing of the goods and merchandise that came in on a ship. And as was stated, it's written in three languages, the Greek, the Coptic, and the hieroglyphic. And so by the scholars understanding the Greek and the Coptic, they could figure out what the hieroglyphic. The actual stone itself is now one of the central pieces of the British Museum, which you can see as soon as you go into that museum. Another question? Yes?
The sine curve fascinates us, and our question is the necessity of a civilization falling because we haven't yet figured out how to rule or control or share the wealth properly? Is it a necessity? And at what point does it not be a necessity?
Well, we know in the world of manifestation that forms are temporary, they're transitory, and they have a critical birth or creation or generation, and then gradually grow to a bloom, and then gradually the bloom fades, and again there's a period of inactivity, et cetera, that enriches the growth for everyone else. It would seem that our civilizations are collective masses of souls who are moving through time, reincarnating together under law, and that as the civilization builds in the number of these souls and their creativity and their interaction based on their motive, there is a bloom, there's a fruition. And then gradually as lesser souls, lesser experienced souls move in to the civilization, or maybe souls with a different motivation and a different practice, that culture may then begin to decline. So, but we see that funny little curve, don't we? Everywhere in nature, in heartbeat, in vibration of sound, all over the place. And it's pivotal for the human to turn it on its end and turn it into a cycle to improve things.
It's interesting, if we look at the time in which we are now living, we see it's one of these critical cycles. Obvious chaos and obvious development of new potentialities. I'm just going to mention a few of the things we observe because they're going to be part of the themes we talk about this afternoon. But we notice around us a deepening insecurity and greater inclination in many parts of the world to resort to terrorism, war, and other forms of violence. It's been estimated that the expenditure of military arms in the world is $1 trillion a year. Religious fanaticism, extremist movements are surfacing all over the world. A substantial portion of our city dwellers live in slums, shanty towns, urban ghettos, or threatening life conditions. And we see governments seek to contain violence through organized warfare. 80% of the wealth and resources of the world belong to 1 billion people. The remaining 20% is shared by 5.5 billion people. Climate change threatens to make large areas of the planet unsuitable for human habitation and for an adequate level of food production. The amount of fresh water is diminishing rapidly. Over half the world's population faces water shortages. Now, at the same time, here, even in America, the California Institute of Noetic Sciences shows changes within our subculture, pockets of individuals working together who are completely going in a more constructive direction. There's a shift from competition to reconciliation and partnership, a shift to sufficiency and caring, a shift from outer to inner authority, finding sources of inner knowing, a shift from mechanistic to more living systems, and a shift from separation to wholeness in the community. In her book, Megatrends, Patricia Aberdeen says that $250 billion a year of industry is devoted to the rise of conscious capitalism that makes awareness of our responsibility to the environment key to those industries. So we see movements in the right direction, even in the midst of the chaos we're in. Yes?
Alexander's such an interesting character, larger than life. He's been both glorified and vilified, and we think there's, he was a probably pretty conflicted individual, and he died very young, even by the standards of the day. How much was he responsible for putting forth the Aristotelian idea, which later really took hold in the church, as opposed to the Platonic ideals?
I found nothing in the research I was doing to say that he followed the Aristotelian line of thinking. What I did find was that he took the teachings that he gleaned from Aristotle and became very, very interested in the world. His science was in the plant trade, but he died so early that, frankly, what we're talking about in Alexandria comes about it under the three Ptolemies, the second one in particular.
He seems to be an individual who Aristotelian and the Platonic met.
Yeah.
Aristotle was his instructor, but also his mother was an initiate in one of the mystery schools in Asia. So he had this universal perspective along with the more inductive method of Aristotle. So we can see how the cities he founded could be both cities of the mind as well as materialistic pearls in the world at that time. So we're going to move along to our next presentation. HBB tells us that the chief aim of the founder of the Eclectic Theosophical School, Ammoniosakis, was one of the three objects of its modern successor, the Theosophical Society, which was also, like its predecessor in Alexandria, set up to reconcile all religions, sects, and nations under a common system of ethics based on eternal verities. So our next talk will look at the modern theosophical movement as a successor in a number of ways to the Alexandrian Eclectic School.
Fundamental to those that have sustained and carried anonymously the theosophical movement through time are those that are bold, dare, achieve, and remain silent. A corollary to that effort was phrased by an occult axiom put forth by Paracelsus. power of the disciple, the power of the initiate, is proportionate to his power to resist. In any age where the ethics, the moral, the tolerance, the understanding of unity is not upheld, what greater need for one who realizes that man is more, that we are divine at the root of our nature, and that there are universal ideals and morals that must be lived by in any age and time, than to resist the traditions and mores of any contemporary time. To understand the context of the boom of Alexandria, we have to remember that man, as societies, as cultures and civilizations that have risen to peaks of knowledge and technology millenniums before Alexandria and fallen, that from the occult tradition, how do we understand Alexandria? In Isis and Bel, page 16 and 26. The mysteries themselves had degenerated in a very great degree into mere priestly speculations and religious fraud. Few were the true adepts and initiates, the heirs and descendants of those who had been dispersed by the conquering swords of various invaders of old Egypt. And this, remember the dilemma of academics trying to understand the hieroglyphics and religion of Egypt. The time predicted by the great Hermes in his dialogue with Aesculapius had indeed come. The time when impious foreigners would accuse Egypt of adoring monsters, and naught but the letters engraved in stone upon her monuments would survive. Enigmas incredible to posterity. Their sacred scribes, hieroglyphs, were wanderers upon the face of the earth, obliged from the fear of profanation of the sacred mysteries to seek refuge among the Medic fraternities, known later as the Essenes. Their esoteric knowledge was buried deeper than ever. The triumph brand of Aristotle's pupil, Alexander the Great, swept away that and conflicted with the Platonic knowledge which started from universals, from a knowledge of the understanding of the whole, then fitting the particulars within that context. That was the conflict, starting from the observable universe to try to fathom the mysteries of the unknown, or that great source. It could not be done. You have to start with an understanding from universals to particulars. When we take into consideration that the Gnostics, or early Christians, were but the followers of the old Essenes under a new name, this fact is nothing to be wondered at. So in the reading, we begin to see connections between those groups that in some way or another carried the theosophical movement, not in total, but in fragments, to the present time. In the political opportunity of Alexander, to some degree there was a tolerance and an encouragement of inquiry into knowledge and science. Ammonius Saccas, the god taught, is instrumental in understanding the modern theosophical movement. The methods enjoined to modern students are just about identical to those encouraged by Ammonius Saccas. We are to fathom mysteries of nature by correspondence and nature, correspondence and analogy. As above, so below, in essence, we cannot traipse about the universe yet to know firsthand those mysteries. But what about the little universe man? What's the famous quote from HPB concerning how we can prove God? like a mathematical or geometric proof, prove the soul powers of man. Thus, you prove the reality of the God nature of man. Ammonius Saccas did not commit to writing. As all great teachers, once you give form to those universal ideas, what happens? It manifests into its interpreters, distort and change. All the various lineages that can be traced from the time of Ammonius through the earlier history to the destruction or the closing of the school by Justinian roughly 529 AD, and then the dispersal and persecution of the pagan priests. We trace symbology and ideas to find the identity and see the external work and effort to preserve these eternal truths. But remember, the various secret fraternities, hermetic brotherhoods, are doors that can lead an individual, if he can grasp the transcendental nature of the ideas, to an active philosophy in life that permits the first-hand realization of the eternal ideas. It's that premise set forth by Ammonius that separates theosophy from all external religions, that the living germ of the divine essence that is man, that if one leads the life in time, he will have a first-hand reality and experience of the transcendental nature of his true being. Fundamental concept. Ammonius's objects are directly corresponding to the objects of the eternal theosophical movement. Prior to everything else, one must understand the reality of the unity of all life. It's not a sentiment. It is a fundamental fact, an aspect of the law of life, of that one reality referred to. What else did Ammonius encourage all students to do? By seeking and studying all religions, philosophies, science, one can discern the essential identity of the same teachings. Again, starting from those universals and being rooted in those ideas, one has his own Rosetta Stone to discriminate what is consistent with that core heart doctrine and what students, philosophers, and others have added, changed, and distorted the true teachings. This is why, like Ammonius Saccas, no individual or theosophical organization stands between a student and the ability to go firsthand to the teachings, to study directly, and ultimately to be his own authority, to make his own conclusions, to take what he will according to his own discrimination. And in this context, what is the definition of a disciple? One who takes knowledge, one who applies it to the basis of his actions. So from the time of Ammonius Saccas, and wherever the true effort of the theosophical movement to free the minds of men, to free him from the chains of ignorance so he can realize firsthand his true divinity and his intimate connection with all nature, there we find and can trace the true movement that is as old as man. From the closing of the school and the persecution of the pagan, and that's a word that means much clarification that each student must give for himself. We find that many of those wanderers took refuge in Persia until another political opportunity permitted its introduction back in Europe. One of the greatest Arabian philosophers of that time, inspired by the influx and activity of so many minds that aspired to the assimilation of this universal age-old wisdom, was Goethe. We see a Persian enlightenment that permitted the study and the propagation of what was first termed the classics, but within that study of the classics, the oral history, the occult history of the movement, is that individuals, by those that were truly fit to be called teachers, trained individuals that were fit to receive it. It's those individuals that fulfill the law that are the true links. Around the history of those true initiates, many external poets, mathematicians, writers, doctors, architects, to some degree, manifested aspects of the universal wisdom religion. It was the Moors' occupation of Spain that created a time of tolerance where, again, Jews, Christians, Muslims, all other religions that were openly discussed and practiced, that provided the avenue back into Europe of the suppressed knowledge, we'll call it, of the ancients at this time. The Gnostic traditions, which we have read, is another form of those early Essenes and Christian esotericists, were the basis of the major surge in the 2 of the Albigensian and Cathari heresies, which exposed and gave the true meanings to the symbology that the church co-opted from the pagans, and its true meanings and understanding were lost. In the same period to the Renaissance, there were many secret Hermetic philosophies, specifically those in Germany, were extremely important. Some of what is known of the external manifestation of those secret fraternities under the Rosicrucian symbology. One of the most important historical individuals, however, Paracelsus, thrice, three times great. And we see from that time, literature vowed that began to put forth into the hands of those that were interested the concepts that were suppressed for so long of that ancient wisdom religion. We get to the Renaissance, people being more and older. Leonardo da Vinci, many others, again, taking aspects of what they were exposed to and manifesting it. We move on. Let's move quicker. I see I'm running out of time. In France, you know that saying that in the last 25 years of every century from the time of Saint-Campa, there was a concerted effort to send help to keep alive and awaken the ideas that can free man. In France, Saint Germain, Cagliostro, and Mesmer. Amongst those three, though, the emphasis must be given to Saint Germain, the true initiate, others to varying degrees, and Mesmer, while not perhaps an initiate, perhaps a protege, apply in practice ideas of mesmerism, the ancient laws of magnetism. Thus we bring up to understand the adepts and work of 1875, why in the introduction of the SD, we must begin to give attention to all those that preceded, that set the stage for the presentation of the Theosophical Movement of 1875.
Some questions or comments? Yes.
I've been fascinated by the idea of secret schools and mystery schools. And I've read a lot about them. And what I've read in the past, back in Alexandria, there were actually schools where they were secret because the knowledge was not supposedly, people weren't ready for the knowledge yet. But then as time goes on, I start reading more about Paracelsus, who's supposedly, from what I understand with him, he gained all his knowledge himself through kind of, I don't know, going to the astral plane. And there's a part of me that says that these secret schools now are in a higher plane, and that there's no body of schools here that we can go to. And if there is, I want to find one and go to it. But that's something that I don't have closure in my mind yet.
Yes, to all of the points that you bring. To begin with, it must be understood that those great teachers, those that keep alive and are the living embodiments of the ancient wisdom religion, are in a body now. There are always those in a body now. As the time of Ammonius Saccas, there are those that aspire and prepare to be fit to teach the mysteries. Then there is a time of trial and probation where his true intentions, motive, and strength, because to be an initiate, to live the life required to be a co-worker of nature, one needs courage and extreme will to persevere. And then there is the process of self-induced and self-effort in application of the law, where he becomes a recognized, and he knows that he has become recognized in co-nature. There is an ancient saying that the effort of the neophyte to reach the stage of Buddhahood, he must mount the million steps and thoughts and efforts of all those that have preceded. And in that moment of enlightenment, there is a mystic experience of complete synthesis and assimilation into that effort, into that reality. The same way that it's one that approaches the mysteries must put aside at the very beginning what he thinks in order to learn what is. That the path to knowledge is not to acquire it as something outside of oneself, but to assimilate unto that reality. And those rudimentary attitude changes that must be assimilated or acquired by the aspirant are all the preparation for the effort of his trials that life itself, by his every very effort, will bring upon him. To be an initiate, to be a co-worker, one must free himself from all extraneous influences. And at the very beginning of that endeavor, all nature, beginning with his own, turns against him in order to see who is the master. Those secret societies, there are those secret societies that are secret. And then there are secret societies with secrets.
We thought to draw your attention to the motto above the stage of the Ethical Humanist Society, the organization that so graciously allowed us to use their facility today. The place where we meet to seek the highest is holy ground. If we wish to meet the Master, the Adepts, face to face, to a certain extent, it can be done on the physical plane, but the real meeting place is the holy ground of our highest consciousness. So they are always available to us if we approach it with the right attitude of heart and mind.
If I can just add one thing, the sincerity of your questions reveals how important this may be to you. The first experiences that one begins to have when he makes an effort to change and live by a universal code is that he has an inner experience that confirms to him firsthand that he is more than his body. He may not have the clarity and understanding of what he has witnessed, but from that experience there is a energy, a recommitment that despite the external obstacles and barriers to his search, he will persist. And the first test is whether or not he will persist despite those obstacles.
May I add something? There's another statement, I think, which is very important, is that through their philosophy, we can reach them. And the philosophy is recorded in the Secret Doctrine and the Isis Unveil. And a lot of the present students' opinion is that those books are archaic and very difficult to read. But as the student moves along, some internal centers become activated, making it possible for us to understand what is in those books. And it is stated that if they really would show themselves to us, we would bow down to them because they are so much higher than average humanity supposes at this level to be at. So the sure way is to study their philosophy and reach them through that philosophy, because there are steps, as the other students said, that will become internally available to the one who is really seeking honestly, steadfastly, and sincerely.
Well, that comment is a good lead-in to our next presentation. The fact that we face such difficult times, chaos, deterioration of society is certainly not by accident. As we understand, it is the lawful result of our thinking. And if we want things to change, we need to change the basis by which we think. Of course, one does not have to be a disciple on the path to this highest knowledge to begin to change their thinking and begin to make a change in the world. That alchemical stone, that universal solvent that helps us transform ourselves into the world around and the world around us, to unify all the disparaging elements in ourselves and nature into one, that solvent and that stone is, as said, the philosophy, which is synthesized and summarized in the fundamental principles, which we will now have presented along with their practical application in part to our problems today.
Just heard that this wisdom of the ages is always present in the world, and at times it goes underground and then it comes into the world again. And a synopsis of that was given, how it went underground at the end of the 5th century and then by the 9th through the Spanish link verses of HPB prepared the ground, so to speak, for her presence in the 19th century. There were quite a few cycles coming together at that time. So the masters came out in force and presented to us these basic principles through which we can modify our lives and in a united fashion become a benefit to society. So what are these principles? There are three of them, as you're aware. The first one is an omnipresent, eternal, boundless, and immutable principle on which all speculation is impossible. I'm just reading it from the Secret Doctrines. Since it transcends the power of human conception and could only be dwarfed by any human expression or similitude. So how do we make this kind of concept clear to our mind and be able to understand it, not only philosophically, but understand it well enough that we can apply it to our daily lives? In the Eastern literature, this one absolute principle is referred to as Parabrahma, and it is stated that it is being and non-being at the same time, and it is given the title Sat, or beingness. So this impersonal principle then, which is the basis of everything that comes out in the process of evolution, has to come from above to below, because we as human beings are a miniature copy of the cosmos. Please keep that in mind. So that the first manifestation, which is referred to in the Secret Doctrine, is called the first logos, and it is so exalted, it is considered unmanifested. But nevertheless, it gives out that primary radiation from the absolute, linking what is unknowable to what is going to be presented to us in our universe, in the cosmos. And then, this unconscious emittance of that ray brings about two aspects, the spirit, matter. And we're definitely and repeatedly told that these two aspects are co-joined, just like when you look at a coin and it has two faces, these two are co-joined as well. One without the other cannot find any expression. The spiritual is invisible. It is the basis of everything that comes about because it is omnipresent, as we just read, and it is everywhere, even if we don't see it, it is there. And it upholds what comes through emanation and concretization into our world. So the spirit matter is called in the Secret Doctrine Purusha and Prakriti. What follows that is cosmic ideation, which is what is in the divine mind being imprinted on this great expanse of our universe as to what is going to happen in that period called Manvantara, which is a very large age. It has four yugas in it, which are smaller periods. We, humanity in the West, as well as India in the East, is in Kali Yuga, it is stated, which is the fourth division, fourth yuga. It is dark, and we have just talked about its ramifications in our society and what it brings about. It is fast, and it brings about change very effectively. So this imprint, then, that takes place is what we call operations of nature. Nature is intelligent. There is an evolvement from inside out, as each human being does also. So this is the first fundamental. The second fundamental, I'm going to go through these fundamentals briefly, and as time permits, I'll come back and talk about them in general and give examples, specific examples, so that I don't run out of time and just talk about one thing only. The second fundamental is that great law of periodicity, and it is one of the universal laws of nature that we see all around us, such as day and night, birth and decay and death, night and day. So it is universal to all of the kingdoms of nature, and it is very fundamental. It is a circle. What is a circle? It's like a serpent biting its own tail, is it not? That circle. And when the circle has a point in its center, that is what indicates manifestation. In other words, we're coming out of a rest period, and now we're going into a manvantara, or existence. The two principles that we talked about earlier, Parabrahman and Vlakprakriti, which is the root of what is going to happen, the spirit, substance, which later on becomes matter, is under cyclic law. The universe in its totality, with it meaning everything which is on it as well as in it, comes out for a period of manifestation, and when it has reached the limit of its perfectibility for that period, and then it disappears again. So what causes that to come about? If you read the modern scientific literature, according to them, either a comet is going to fall into us, or we are going to fall into the sun, and that is how we are going to come to an end. But that is not the proposed philosophy that explains that. Mr. Judge has a very good explanation of that theory in The Ocean of Theosophy, where he says, man is a dynamo himself, and what he does, what he thinks, and what he says brings about tremendous change in our universe. So we need to be very aware of what exactly we are doing, because the miniature copy of that cosmos is what really propels as to what is going to be in our universe. We are the propellers of that force. And in one of the Upanishads, it is saying that the self is in existent in all things, and the self is also in us. So how are we different from one another? Are we different from one another? We look at each other and we see the image. The image is different. That is the clay that they talk about being on the surface of that break within each human, and that is the soul. Our soul and spirit, which is inherent, perfect, is the same in each human being. The difference is in the lower aspects of us, which is what we are here to change. So that periodicity then enables the universe to come out and disappear. And in between, the Kali Yuga is 432,000 years, 5,000 years of which had been spent in 1897-98 period. So we have gone another 120 or 30 odd years beyond that. And its beginning was marked by Krishna's death, and we have a very long way to go until it ends. And from what we have taught, we have seen that this deterioration is happening all around us. But what is also present, as stated and reiterated, are these centers of light, centers of light. Each human being can become a center of light from the studying the philosophy, understanding it, promulgating it, and exemplifying it in our own lives. This is what makes theosophy come alive, which is very necessary. We cannot just talk about it. HPV says the end of a man is action. So we need to act on the principles that we absorb and promulgate in the world. What is the third proposal, or the third fundamental? The third fundamental principle states that each human soul is a ray of the oversoul. We did say at the beginning that this spiritual essence is omniscient and omnipresent. It is everywhere. And in the secret what is that? What are we talking about? In 289, page 289 of Sacred Doctrine 1, there's a very succinct passage that I recommend for everyone to read and understand. We are told that Akasha, the plastic Akasha, is the first that comes alive at the beginning of each Pandavantara. And it is said that it is both the spiritual, but it has an existence, so it is also substance, but it is a spiritual substance. It is very, very succinct what they're telling us in that passage. So this soul, the essence in each one of us, is one with the oversoul. So this theory then is what gives basis to what brotherhood and unity are. It's not just a word, this statement, that we're all one. In its essence, we are truly all one. Even if we don't see that essence in each human heart, when the Hindu bows, he or she is bowing to the soul in the heart. We need to also understand that that is alive, that is who we really are, not the clay on the surface of it, but this real essence in the heart. So this proposes then that that divine Buddhi, which is the essence, cannot become a self-conscious entity until the life wave of the, or the monad has gone through all of the kingdoms of nature and has gained experience and consciousness and becoming self-conscious only in the human kingdom. So this gives us tremendous responsibility to the kingdoms below us as well as to the kingdoms above. All of our principles are gifts from hierarchies in the universe. What is it that we have that truly belongs to us? It is all borrowed. Our material substance is the same. We're using the same substance. We look different because under karma, this evolutionary process takes place, and our physical form is different. But the substance that we use is the same. So, let us look at examples then and exemplify how this can be applied to our daily lives, starting with the third, for instance. As above, so below, we're a miniature copy of the cosmos. And the substance that starts, which is homogeneous in Akasha, finds itself in our universe as concretized spirit, because it's the opposite pole of a spirit. It is concretized as matter. How do we use that? Because this is a very simple thing and we can all identify with it. How do we use it? How do you use the matter that has been entrusted to us? Again, let us quote from Mr. Judge. He says, when our manmantara starts, a particular vibration is given to that substance, and that is what keeps the yuga going, because its vibration is going to last through all of the changes that we go through. So that substance is bright and it is vibrant, and we take it and make our physical bodies with it. What are we made up of? Atoms and molecules. Do we really see them? Do we know what they are? Without going into that, because even science cannot say that they know it, they have an idea as to the boundary of the cell and where the electrons might be. So there's a cloud and it contains it. In us, these beings find substance. How are we feeding them? How are we using them? First, molecules and atoms are used over and over again. We just said our yuga, the Kali Yuga, is 432,000 years. So we are using this material over and over again. Just like those civilizations that came and left before us, we shall also leave this substance to the generations that are coming after us. So how we imprint it, because we are all electromagnetic, and we leave our imprint on the substance, we need to be very careful about our thought process, how kind, gentle, generous, or mean we are, and how we are going to benefited for the future generations that are coming after us, because when these lives, is what they're called in the secret doctrine, are going to be constituting our physical bodies or physical bodies of others in the future, what is it that they're going to do? They will act according to the imprint that we have given them, wouldn't they? They have our imprint, and they're going to act according to that imprint that we have put on them. Okay. So this then exemplifies that great principle of unity, that we are all in it together, and not one of its units can go far ahead of the rest of the units. We truly are one human family, and all of the kingdoms below us also use the leftover substances from us. And when you look at the character of the animals, then we can understand what it is that we are doing. What kind of animals are there in the universe? We have crocodiles, we have lions, we have tigers. Where is this character coming from? From us. So, according to three fundamental propositions, then, our aim is to develop the higher aspects of us. We are called the Aryan race, Arya, noble. So let us then cultivate the noble qualities. What are those? Doing more for the other, which is what HPB tells us in the key, and considering this self the least, becoming, in other words, selfless. Do charity, she says, one-on-one. Do you know the people in your neighborhood? Would we know who would need something? This student saw this example in the grandmother who used to feed the poor in the neighborhood. So there are a lot of suggestions in the key, which is very practical, and I'm sorry, I've run out of time. Perhaps we can discuss it a little bit further in the question and answer session.
Thank you for that excellent overview. And actually, we're going to be discussing the practical ramifications of those ideas throughout the rest of the morning and this afternoon, so you'll have many opportunities to explore them. So we'll start by taking some basic questions or comments you may have for the presenter. Yes? By seeing the soul as being ageless and sexless, does that help us see the divine principle in all beings?
In its upper aspects, the self that is within is truly sexless. But as human beings, when we are incarnation, we come as one or the other. We are both. We are androgynous. But one is suppressed and one is expressed. So what does that really say? We were androgynous in the third race, and we divided into sexes at the end of that race. We are truly divine human beings, because what was the aim as well of HPV coming in the 19th century was to bring about a change in the buddhimanas of the race, whole of humanity. In the third, we were divine human beings because buddhimanas was expressed. But in Kali Yuga, it is kama manas which is expressed. And that was what they wanted to change about. For that change to come about, that we again express our divinity rather than the lower aspects having the ascendancy. So, to your question, the self is sexless, and when we express the highest in us, then we are truly expressing the higher aspirations of that soul. Because who are we? We are that soul, but nothing else. We look at our bodies and think that we're this, but we really are not. We're the soul. That's who we are. Sexless and bright.
Yes.
We might have misunderstood, but we thought we heard one unit cannot move far ahead of the rest of the units. And if we understand that, our question would be, then what is an adept or a master who has, through work, moved ahead, perfected themselves to a level where hopefully they come back to help struggling humanity? But did we misunderstand the intent there?
How do we reconcile the idea that there's a limit to how far one can move ahead of the rest of humanity because of our interconnectedness, with the idea of that, of the ideal in fact of there being perfected human beings who would seem to represent the highest possibilities?
There are perfected beings because they are a brotherhood. There are Nirmanakayas, masters, Buddhas, they indeed do exist. But do they belong to this Manvantara or are they from previous Manvantaras is the first question that we need to ask. And that perfectibility also takes place in stages, that the paramitas in the voice of the silence indeed shows us what the path is and how we are going to walk that path. And the aim, HPV says, ought to be that we influence one another to also come along onto that path, that saving our selfish selves is not the purpose. It is to help the other get on the path is the purpose. So when you link those ideas together, it becomes very apparent that we cannot truly go very far ahead when it becomes a responsibility to pull all that we can with us as we are progressing on that purification and assimilation process.
With the question, there is always, with many theosophical ideas, the general expression and then exceptions. But what has been discussed about the path that leads to aspiring to the mystery schools, the process of probation, initiation, and if one achieves, can be likened to a quickened period of evolution, because that whole process speeds the evolution. But if one begins to read and acquire the requirements to start that process, it weeds out the multitudes. It is a very difficult journey. All must eventually face the choice of whether to proceed on that path or not. But it is possible through that process to speed up our evolution and create instruments that can increasingly manifest to a greater capacity the divine knowledge and power at the root of our nature.
Yes. The question presents the idea that at the same time we bring along ourselves as individuals into higher degrees of development, are we not also responsible to bring along others? Perhaps that's part of that idea that one cannot be advancing so long for themselves individually unless they bring along others with them. So perhaps you wanted to address that comment?
Well, first of all, let us make a distinction between what self we are talking about, because there are two. One is the lower self in this literature anyway, which is the personality, who I am, my name, and what I come across as. And that the other one is that bright ray that we talked about, which is in the heart of each human being, would then represent the ray that comes from the essence, the core of that oversoul. And each one of us do have one in the heart. So the connectivity then is to the root. We are all coming from the same essence. But nevertheless, it does have an individualized existence because we are individuals, as you expressed. What the suggestion is that not to give in to the personality and its wants and needs, because it is selfish. The lower self is very selfish. The personality puts itself in the center and consider itself the totality. With the lower mind, which is our intellectual mind, and we do have a divine mind as well, the lower mind, with the tendency of passions and desires, pulls the individuality downwards. And what it is suggested in these writings is, in order to express the noble aspects of us, to kind of overcome that personality, not give into it. When you look around, there are human beings who are very deprived. They do not have the circumstances or the material well-being to develop their inner self or outwardly to progress. And when we say help, this is what we're talking about, the amelioration of the conditions of the poor, that they also have an opportunity to join in this process of advancement. So there's a play there with the lower and the higher, and we need to understand that first. And then if we are all pilgrims in this progression, which is always towards a higher expression of itself, then it becomes truly our duty to help those around us as we go through that process ourselves.
In consideration of that point, it's really, really important that we not see life or see mankind as schizoid. Maybe it would help if we use the analogy of a transmission of radio signals. There is that which is, that is universal, that is like a radio signal transmitting, vibrating across time and place, moment to moment. And then as that signal can be focused, whether it is tuned in a willful way by mind desiring to be focused and higher, spiritual, or whether it is tuned out and therefore the vibration is static, just noise, it's one vibration, it is one generation, if you will, and there is a will and a perceiver that is doing the tuning, either for the higher self and a universal application, or for a lower staticky, self-centered, self-serving application.
It takes a strong personality to start this path and make a change. It said we start in selfishness. As we learn and practice, we try to be unselfish. As unselfishness becomes ingrained in action, it leads to altruism. And in fact, one definition of occultism is the practice of altruism manifested. When we are practicing and achieving altruism, the next transcendental change is then selflessness. The embodiment of that is expressed in a mystic phrase, when one casts no shadow.
Thank you. we can see that as in the city of the mind in Alexandria and even today, even these fundamental ideas of theosophy can occupy the greatest minds. And yet it is said by Mr. Judge that such fundamental ideas as reincarnation and karma would not overwhelm the understanding of a child. In fact, we are told this is what the West needs most. And we might even say in our time what humanity needs most as we witness the global crisis around us and how it affects our understanding of ourselves and how we lose a sense of our hope and dignity as human beings. We think one of the key ideas that HPB presents to us that's sort of been the backdrop of this morning's presentations is this quote, which we're sure you all know of. It is brotherly love, mutual help, unswerving devotion to truth. If once men do not realize that in these alone can true happiness be found, and never in wealth, possessions, or any selfish gratification, then the dark clouds will roll away, and a new humanity will be born upon earth. Then the golden age will be there indeed. But if not, then the storm will burst, and our boasted Western civilization and enlightenment will sink in such a sea of horror that its parallel in history has never yet been recorded. And if we look at the consensus of opinion of philosophers, scientists, sociologists, what they tell us, are we heading in the right direction? What will happen if we continue with business as usual and do not make the changes? They pretty much agree with HPB that we'll continue to see more drought, devastating storms, harvest failures, famine, water shortages, flooding, massive immigration of individuals into other areas competing for land, heat waves, pestilence, contaminated water, epidemics, increasing terrorist groups, nuclear proliferation, narco-traffickers, and organized crime, increased military spending, spiraling arms races, military conflict with conventional and non-conventional weapons, global economic stagnation, international economic financial system failures, exploitation of the soil, overfishing of the seas, decreased international food reserves. These are not doomsday scenarios. To a certain extent, we are already witnessing these things. It's a question of whether humanity collectively and individuals in smaller nucleuses set up the causes that will counteract them. And key to this is an understanding of reincarnation and karma. So our final presentation for this morning will be on reincarnation and karma, the lost chords of hope and dignity.
Presentation so far, this student came to realize that it was no accident that karma and reincarnation, these subjects, these laws, would end this morning's presentation. Continuing on with an HPB quote that Dr. mentioned, if theosophist doctrine, HPB said, of reincarnation and karma, in other words, of hope and responsibility, find a home in the lives of the new generations, then indeed will dawn the day of joy and gladness for all who now suffer and are outcast. HPB said that we consider karma as the ultimate law of the universe, the source, the origin, and the fount of all other laws that exist throughout nature. Karma is the unerring law which adjusts effect to cause on the physical, mental, and spiritual plains of Veer. No cause remains without this due effect. From the greatest cosmic disturbance down to the movement of our hand. Karma is that unseen and unknown law which adjusts wisely, intelligently, and equitably each effect to its cause, tracing the effect back to the producer. We do not know what karma exactly is in its essence, but we do know how it works, and we can define and describe its mode of action with accuracy, HPB said. Under karmic cycles, we talked about cycles a bit this morning, karma that we create in the life, in this life, predestines conditions for the future births of all under the law of evolution, which is now carrying us along the ascending arc of our cycle. So what this says listed is, once we get karma in motion, we need to consider living it out and not trying to ask for forgiveness, etc. We have set it in motion, it's up to us to live it out and benefit from that karma. The idea is that karma is there to help us in many ways, sometimes in some ways we don't understand it because it's very difficult to live through some of the circumstances, but that's the way the law is. So these cycles, these wheels within wheels, do not affect all mankind at one and the same time, and the system of cycles cannot be comprehended if spiritual action preordained by karmic law is separated from their physical course, as we so often do these days, and was also discussed previously by other speakers. The grand cycle, then, the huge cycle, with which these smaller cycles are within, runs through the inner cycles of man's progressive evolution, from the ethereal down to the purely physical, down to the redemption of man from his coat of skin and matter, after which it continues running its course downward and then upward again. So it is not karma that rewards or punishes, but it is we who reward or punish ourselves according to whether we work with or break the laws of nature. Karma does not act in this or that particular way always, but it always acts so as to restore harmony and preserve the balance of equilibrium of the universe. We can think of it this way. A stone falls into the water of a pond and creates disturbing waves. These waves oscillate backwards and forwards till they are brought to rest and the water returns to its condition of calm tranquility. Similarly, the consequences of a person's deeds and thoughts must all react upon himself with the same force with which they were set in motion. Under the law of balance and equilibrium, the fresh pouring in or arrival of new human monads ceased as soon as humanity had reached its full physical development. Therefore, no fresh monads have incarnated since the middle point of the Atlanteans, and no spiritual entity can reincarnate before a period of many centuries has elapsed. Hence the assertion that many of us are now working off the effects of the evil karmic causes produced by us in Atlantean bodies. Exceptions to this rule include the case of young children and of individuals whose lives were violently cut off. Most of us do not remember our past lives now, but there are plenty of documented cases of those who have. In recent years, James Leninger told his parents, he was James III, At a very young age, he recounted in detail his previous life as James II, up to the time when the Corsair plane, he knew what kind of plane he was flying, he piloted as Lieutenant James Houston, Jr., was shot down over Japan near the end of World War II. And there were a lot more details that came out in Dateline several years ago on this particular situation, in his previous life. The law of karma and its twin doctrine, reincarnation, is the only doctrine that can explain the mysterious problem of good and evil and reconcile man to the terrible and apparent injustice of life. This philosophical belief is based on every reasonable evidence and life experience in karma analysis or the law of retribution. This law predestines nothing and no one. It exists from and in eternity. It cannot be said to act, for it is action itself. Karma has never sought to destroy intellectual and individual liberty like the God invented by the monotheist. It has not looked and invoked its decrees and darkness purposely to perplex men, nor shall it punish him who dares to scrutinize its mysteries. On the contrary, he who unveils through study and meditation its intricate paths and throws light on those dark ways, in the windings of which so many people perish due to their ignorance, is working for the good of his fellow man. Along with karma is the law of reincarnation, whereby the same spiritual individuality is reborn in a long series of personalities. Theosophists distinguish between the bundle of experiences, which we call the false personality, and that element in man to which the feeling I am I is due. It is this I am I, which we call the true individuality. And we say that this ego or individuality plays like an actor, many parts on the stage of life. This ego is a spark from the one ocean of divine fire. Our God within us, or our Father in secret, or what we call the higher self, Atman. HPB refers to volume 2, page 593, in presenting this information of Isis Unveiled on the inner man, where there's a statement about karma that from birth to death, every person is weaving thread by thread around himself as a spider does his cobweb, his future. Reincarnation means that the ego, which we are, will be furnished with a new body, a new brain, and a new memory. The same unerring, wise, and just rather than merciful law, which inflicts upon the incarnated ego the karmic punishment to every sin committed during the preceding life on earth, provides for the disembodied entity mental rest, leaving in the soul memory but the reminiscence of that which was bliss or led to happiness while in body. The Devakani, which is called that when it's disembodied, lives throughout centuries an existence of happiness, which is the reward for its suffering in earth life. Karma, with its army of skandhas, waits at the threshold of Devatan, whence the ego reemerges to assume a new incarnation. It is into no imaginary hell that the ego is cast, but verily home to the earth. It is as he has sown, so will he reap. Reincarnation will neither gather around him all those other egos, will gather around him all those other egos who have suffered at his hands. We believe that the unknown universal deity is represented by karma, a power which cannot fail, and can therefore have neither wrath nor mercy, only absolute equity, which leaves every cause to work out its inevitable effects. The sayings of Jesus are with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. We find that in Matthew chapter 7, verse 2. A person who, believing in karma, refuses to forgive every injury and render good for evil is a criminal and only hurts himself. So we talk about atoms. Every atom that is subject to the general law governing the whole body to which it belongs. Under this general law, the aggregate of individual karma becomes that of the nation to which those individuals belong. And further, the sum total of national karma is that of the world. No person can rise above his individual failings without lifting the whole body to which he is an integral part. No one can sin nor suffer the effects of sin alone. So karma is distributed because we are interdependent. There is no such thing as a concept of separateness in reality, as has been asserted by many of these states. When every individual has contributed to the general good what he can in money, labor, and ennobling thought, then and only then will the balance of national karma be struck. It is the development of humanity that the theosophist has always in view, and he knows that any failure on his part to respond to the highest within him retards not only himself, but all.
There is no beginning or end to the application of this doctrine of reincarnation to our present problem. However, there is, unfortunately, a beginning or end to our presentation. So welcome to your this discussion, your comments and questions. Yes.
The karma of this country, speaking of North America, we have such wonderful principles, and maybe as best as can be put forth at this time. And yet, you know, we're involved in many wars, but we always seem to take the refugees here. So it does seem schizoid. It really does. It's just, we often act, it's just, it's crazy. I mean, we do such wonderful things, and yet we're involved in some things that are definitely not wonderful.
Any comment on the national karma?
Well, your comment reminds me of this quote on the board earlier in this presentation. What sometimes seems to be chaotic, maybe things falling into place. It certainly seems to this student as well that we are in great chaos. But then we think about the words of the founding fathers, and also we hear about the guidance that the adepts and so forth have given the founding fathers in setting up the principles of this nation. These principles are very lofty, and it's very difficult for us as humanity in our stage of development to reach up to those principles. And we falter as individuals. We falter as nations, and it's all of a learning process. The idea is what we do with that information, and the idea is that we treat every action at the grassroots level. Are our thoughts, our actions based for the benefit of the all, or are they for selfish reasons? And until we get to the point, each individual, it's based on the universal principles, we're going to have these difficulties in one form or another. So that's why it's so important that we take it upon ourselves to be leaders. Every one of us is a leader. And we need to do that.
In this last Wednesday's ocean class, ULT in Philadelphia, in the subject of cycles, quite a bit of time in class was spending on discussing the phrase, under karma, we get what we deserve. And of course, we can read that in two ways. Karma brings us the results of our previous errors by which we can learn, but also brings us what we deserve in the sense of opportunities. It brings us all the good we've done in the past and brings us what we deserve as divine human beings with the potential to make changes. Without this law, we could not bring forth progress through evolution. Yes?
Listening so far, it appears that we are what we have thought. And we'll save the other part of our comment for later this afternoon. Perhaps other questions might be answered in the platform. So we're talking about what's going on around us, and you're saying we are what we have thought. There must be a connection somewhere in there. So we could bring that out later on this afternoon with an example.
We are what we thought.
Absolutely. Just one little quick comment. Thought precedes action, and we can control our thoughts by self-induced and self-devised efforts. I'm just going to roll that in. And
can I make a comment?
Yes, please.
To the first question, but Jesus also said, ye be separate. It doesn't mean that we have to go along with all the policies that our nation puts forth. For instance, everywhere it is stated that war does not solve any problems. So should we agree that we should be involved in wars around the globe? We are individuals and we can become centers of force unto ourselves and those around us, influencing what we think is the right action and not go along with it.
And look what happened in Egypt. That was all grassroots starting.
It was all grassroots. And what's also interesting is if we consider this morning and the activities in this building, while there may be tremendous chaos out in the streets, maybe a few blocks from here,
or upstairs,
and while our discussion has been an effort to understand some ancient information and to see how it appears and disappears, upstairs there was a group of very tiny children who were enjoying a little Saturday camp, very innocent, brought here by parents who were looking for their typical Saturday morning activity, and were reminded that if the new scientific investigations of mind and heart radiating vibrations and affecting the charge or the frequency in a bowl of yogurt or in a glass of water, if that's actually the case, we can only imagine what the karma was of the little guys that just left the building not so long ago. There are no accidents.
I think there was a hand in the back row. Did you have your hand? Yes.
Just along those lines of thinking, we'd like to comment that two studies have been developed, one in quantum physics about the actuality of two isolated events affecting each other with no tracing of energy, so far as science knows, in between the two.
Right.
And so that's got to speak volumes for the mystery of what can be unveiled. Another one was an experiment in D.C., a crime-ridden town, as we know, in a way, about people who, over the course of the summer, meditated on reducing the crime. They didn't actively take any outward goals to reduce the crime. They just meditated on the reduction of the crime, and that the numbers actually dropped to a severe rate.
Yes.
So this power of thinking and extending beyond this point.
Thank you for those contributions, and we will be covering some of that mind science research in one of the presentations this afternoon. Yes.
With so many of the mysteries along the lines of this questioner, there's that which is referred to as the astral light. It's said that all thought not only coalesces with an elemental life of force, but we create thought forms. And that in the medium that pervades all, those collective thought forms reflect on our consciousness to the degree of affinities with what particular thought forms, so we can be influenced. Likewise, the influence of a positive thought form from so many can ameliorate or keep in check some of those other tendencies. And it's along those lines that HPB said that while there may be no devil in the sense of the theological definition, but imagine the worst collective thinking of humanity taking a form and those thought forms and reflecting back to influence individuals.
One more question.
And to counteract that, we see above the speakers, the place where we need to seek the highest is holy ground. So if we begin to understand it's not the ground under our feet, but rather this vehicle, which is holy because it contains the spiritual essence, we can begin to act from the higher once we begin to realize that.
Good time for one more.
It's interesting in regard when we're looking at karma and where people are placed. Somebody said, "Be come ye out and be separate." Well, it's interesting because we can feel as though, oh my goodness, I wish I could do something about what's going on in my town. And sometimes just feel overwhelmed, oh no, I can't start. But we can start right around us. But the interesting thing is that periodically we hear about one person, we're talking about grassroots movements, that one person has been able to, and you hear this all over the country, all over the world, how one person can make a difference in the world. So we never know where we're going to be placed.
Could I add to that, that one person does make a difference. We have no choice. We will make a difference one way or the other.
Yeah, thank you for that contribution. Once again, we hope to be able to demonstrate that this afternoon. So we think it's fitting to close this morning's section with a minute on Philadelphia history, since we have a historical perspective this morning. As we mentioned, there are four squares, the Southwest Square, later named Rittenhouse Square, after one of the early industrial leaders in Philadelphia. And as we said, as the city prospered in the 1800s, the wealthier moved west up along Walnut Street here. And this area actually was sort of the summer and getaways for those hardworking people down by Society Hill. And one of the more prominent families, the Wanamaker family, the Wanamaker department stores, as the Macy department stores later representing that burgeoning industry. The Wanamaker family moved west, and one of the Wanamaker estates is now the home of the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia, which we all hope you will visit at 1917 Walnut Street. It's right across the Rittenhouse Square. And if you do come, and we wish you will, we are offering a vegetarian lunch and beverage and the opportunity to see this beautiful landmark in Philadelphia as well as the center of theosophical activities here in this region. So we'll close this morning and hope to see you back promptly at 2:30.
You know the comment about one person making a difference?
Yeah.
That triggered so many images.